Okay.
Oh, one second. Leah is coming. Leah's part second.
Batteries are not included.
Okay. Thank you very much. I'm actually very excited about this speech for the following reason. When I was an undergraduate at Yeshiva, I was an economics major, largely because I saw it as a way to graduate as fast as possible, and I wasn't really sure what I was going to do. The head of the economics department was a fellow, Rabbi Dr. Aaron Levine, who seemed to be a nice enough fellow. And after taking a few courses, I went over to him and I said, I'm going to be honest with you here. I'm not here because of the economics. I'm here because I think it's a quick way to graduate, but I happen to really take a liking to you. And you, I understand, are a Talmud Chacham extraordinaire. Would it be possible that we could arrange some sort of directed study under which I would learn with you and you would give me credit towards my major? Surprisingly, he said yes. Under his tutelage, I worked on unions and halacha. I was very inspired by him. I went to law school because of him. A lot of who I am is because of him. And eventually, last year, it was a very exciting time for the people in the field, Oxford University accepted economics and Jewish law as an official field of study. And to celebrate that, they came out with a volume, the Handbook of Economics and Jewish Law, which was edited for the Oxford University Press by Rabbi Levine. And I wrote the chapter on unions. So this is something that's very dear to me. On the other hand, so Rabbi Levine always would encourage me, I need to publish more. And I would explain to him that at the end of the day, please have a seat. At the end of the day, no one cares about this. I speak all over the country, and this is a year where labor unions and strikes are really at the forefront. You think about Wisconsin. You think about the NFL, not necessarily in that order. You think about the NBA. This is a year where labor issues have really come forward and been very important. Still, I said, if I would walk into almost any community and say, I'd like to speak about labor law, they would laugh me out. So this is actually the first community that would ever agree to listen to labor law, and therefore I thank you. But you might regret it, but until then, thank you very much. Why does this matter? Let's start with that question. I tell you, I work on the Beit Din. If there ever would be a union question, I am sure they would sit me on the case. I'm yet to get one. I'm not expecting to get one in the near future. Just a few thoughts to consider. Right now, the Israeli population is approximately 40% Orthodox. Give or take, it's depending how you will work it out. Right now, if you do the math, you look at the demographics, the birth rate for the Orthodox is significantly higher than it is for the non-Orthodox, around 5.5 per to 2.5 per, if you're looking at particularly the Haredi community. And also, a stronger percentage of people who make Aliyah tend to be from the Orthodox camp, and people who make Yeridah, the numbers tend to go the other way. If everything would follow this way over the next 20 years, Israel would become over 50% Orthodox. And at that time, it would be what to talk about in terms of adjusting Israeli law to meet up with halacha. Right now, Israeli law is a compilation largely of English common law, some Turkish law. We still have some leftovers there. What? And whatever else has fallen in, right? The question is whether or not there comes a point in history, hopefully in the near future, where one can talk about taking the laws, not religious laws. We're not talking about stoning people if they don't keep Shabbos. We're talking about looking at labor laws. We're talking about standard civil law, and taking the rich history that we have and putting that rich history into the land of Israel practically. And the question is, how will that work? Will that work, in fact? It's a good question that, we should probably be working on at this point. So this shiur, to a certain extent, is theoretical. Not totally, but partially it is theoretical. But hopefully this is something which is not just theoretical that will never happen, but it's theoretical that's something that we have to consider down the line. The concept of unions is actually an ancient concept as far as the Gemara is concerned. The first of our sources here is a Gemara in Sukkah, which discusses the great synagogue of Alexandria. There was a great synagogue in Alexandria. This goes back many, many years, right, this goes back to the times of the Beis HaMikdash, of which if you read through the entire Gemara, it talks about that it had a seating capacity of 1.2 million, it would fill up, that in fact, as Moshe's eye was a little bit noisy, we have 1.2 million people, hearing the chazan's a little hard, they'd explain that they had flags to explain when it's time to say Amen and whatnot, and in the discussion, something that certain shuls might want to consider, but in the discussion of the synagogue, they explain that there were specific seating areas for different professions. And that's what we translate into English here, that in fact that each profession would have their own separate area. And it wasn't just because it was easier to talk shop with the guy who was in your, if the other lawyers were sitting next to you, but rather it was a matter that this was a setup where people who were new to the community, people that were having financial difficulties, could go to this section, could go to their people, and there was some, what we would call at the time, a guild, where they would take care of the members of their own profession. So this idea that of people of the same profession banding together in Jewish law goes back over 2,000 years.
It's not the same as a union.
No, not at all. That is not the same. But again, there is this. Yeah, what the Gemara here says is that they did support one another, right? That money had to come from somewhere. There was something. It would seem that there was some communal pot that they kept, and that's from that they gave out. So this concept of banding together goes back that far. The concept of actually having unions, where you're having rules, that goes back to the time of the Tosefta. Tosefta also is around 2,000 years ago, and if you take a look at the Tosefta in Bava Metzia, which is number 2 on the sheet, the Tosefta says, "Narisham hanachtom lasos regia beinehem." The Shem Chamor Lomar, "Kol mi shetamos chamoro namid lo chamor acher." Masa bebusia in tzrich lahamid lo chamor acher. It talks about that there was an agreement that everyone would put in money. So it's sort of an insurance. Everyone would pull their money together. Everybody was a donkey driver. So in the event you would lose your donkey, that would be a tremendous hit. So in order to make up for that, everyone put in a little money, and that was your insurance. Right? This is a way of spreading the risk. And in fact, it goes on to say, not only that, but as the Tosefta goes on, it says that you don't have a right to opt out. This was mandatory insurance, right? State-sponsored, almost, that you had this idea that everybody would have to be part of it. So this is, again, not the unions that we know, but it's more, right, that we are forcing people to be part of it, and it provides somewhat of a safety net to the people around it. Finally, the step that we really need to get there is the third one of Gemara Barabrasra, which it also doesn't totally get it. Rishoyim b'nei Yer, ahasnos al amidos v'al shorim v'al schar polim v'asiel kitzonsom. Translated, the townsmen have the right to fix weights and measures, prices and wages, inflict penalties on infringement of these rules. So obviously this isn't a union, this is the idea of a government. A government has a right to impose price ceilings, has a right to impose proper measures. In fact, this is what all governments have done over the years. So we have this idea that the workers would get together based on their trade, and beyond that we have an idea that there are this idea that you can control the economic flow. Where do you see, though, that last step I'm missing? Right? Obviously, I have one step to go. I see that it can be controlled. I see that there are unions. How do I know that the unions could control it? So that's a story. Everybody likes stories. I like stories. So, number 4, it's translated to you for you in English. Hanu bei trei tafri da'avdi inyone v'hadi adarim. There were two butchers who worked together. And what was their agreement? Their agreement was they were only going to work on certain days. That I'll do Sunday, Tuesday and Wednesday, you'll do Monday, Thursday, Friday. That's what we're going to do. We're going to break up. So therefore, on these given days, we're not competing with each other, right? We're both butchers, right? We both want to make a living. So therefore, we have an agreement. We're going to work together. And then they said, in fact, if one of us starts selling on the other one's day, there'll be a penalty. What happened? So the Gemara tells us that, in fact, one of them did it, and the other one took the penalty. So he sued in court. So what happens? So he says, you don't got to pay. So I'm a Rapapa. Shopping of the law, how do they meet? Rapapa says that is the correct decision. Why? Hani miri hechad lek adam choshev. Ava hechad ika adam choshev lako kmini demasim. So he says that, yes, I agree that you can make such a rule. that workers can agree among themselves, different people can agree among themselves to have certain understandings, and in fact they have a right to collect on those understandings. However, he says, that's only on one condition. The condition is that the Adam Choshev has to approve of this.
But hold on a second. This is not a union at all.
This is two people.
This is a case of a monopoly of capitalists getting together and splitting the market. This is.
So I will put my economist hat now. Aren't all unions a monopoly of capitalists splitting the market?
No, they're a monopoly of labor versus capital. This is, in fact, a discussion of, in a small town without a smart man to run it, allowing the businessman to set up a monopoly, and if there is a businessman, a smart man, to regulate it so, in fact, there's a free market. Far from this having anything to do
with the unions. So again, would you say the case of the chamorim, the donkey drivers, that they're capitalists also?
You know, given their position in ancient times, maybe. In ancient times,
who wasn't the capitalist then?
It may only the slaves and the people like day laborers, but these are donkey drivers own their own donkey. It's no difference when Lloyd's of London was formed and they get made an insurance ring and founded modern insurance. This is exactly the same description. Far from this being about unions, it's about the work. It's not the workers as we understand them. It's the company owners. It's the truckers.
Right, so the
own trucking companies.
So yeah, I failed to see the difference between the idea of the guy who are the truckers who are setting the prices and the workers setting the prices.
If you're going to say that laborers have the right to set a price, yes, they do.
I mean,
these examples are not on the unions. What would be today the union side? None of
them. Again, what are things that unions usually fight for? Let's take the NFL. What are they fighting over?
Share of the proceeds, a share of the
money.
Right?
Money. They want to be paid more. I think that's probably the most basic way of putting it.
Right. For a touchdown.
Right?
Right? Yeah, but they don't own the means of the production. The donkey drivers own the donkeys. And the bankers own the bakery.
I understand that. But the question is, what's the difference here? You know, well, without the football players...
own their own arms and legs. I mean,
no, but it's not the same thing. They're working for a company. The company has a name like the Minnesota Vikings. The guy who owns the Minnesota Vikings is the capitalist. But a donkey driver is like an independent trucker who owns his own rig, is his own company. He's not on the union side.
As part of why we have to root for the Vikings, because the Ziggy Wilf owns it. It's in the contract. But again, the idea that setting prices, what does it make the difference if I'm setting it to the consumer? In the case of the donkey driver, you know, I am the producer and the consumer is the consumer, right? In the case of workers in a GM factory, I am the producer of labor and GM is the consumer.
Yes, but the GM is also the owner of the capital.
That's nice that they do that also.
Owns the donkey.
Right, that is true. I'm not sure why that makes a difference.
While the worker doesn't own the production line.
Right, but I'm not sure why that makes a difference.
It makes a huge difference. That's the definition of worker versus capitalist.
Yes.
Your donkey driver is working with equipment that's relatively cheap. Your trucker, your teamster driving a truck is working with equipment that's relatively expensive.
How do you know?
The donkey driver is working for people who will hire him to load the donkey.
How do you know the donkey's cheap? Maybe a donkey cost a year's wages back then.
But it's relatively cheaper.
Maybe it's a talking donkey.
It's relatively cheaper.
That's a good point.
It's relatively cheaper than a tractor trailer.
Don't hijack the conversation, Jack.
Okay, that's your
point. But that's a point. The owner of the cab is the capitalist. And the company owner. If he doesn't own it, if he only drives it like a renter.
But he's still subject. He's still part of a. He can't just go in and charge whatever he wants. He can't just drive around, let's say, New York City and charge anything he wants.
I think we got to let Rabbi Rapp continue
okay.
with his
Good.
Presentation.
So point,
discuss this
points
afterwards.
All well taken. So, so.
All right.
Moving right along. This is why I don't want to hear about it. So the idea is as follows, that there seems to be an idea here that just like any government has a right to govern its town, its state, its country, and make rules, so too any guild has a right to get together and govern their members as well. However, the Gemara tells us there's a major difference. And the major difference is that unlike the town, the city, the country could make laws as they see fit, in order for the workers to make laws, it is necessary for them to first check off with this Adam Chashuv. What does the word Adam Chashuv mean? Well, it literally means Adam, person. Chashuv, important, an important person. What's an important person? What makes this person important? Why do we care about that? So the general assumption of what the important person is what we call regulation. There is a problem here. The problem is that if we allow workers or producers to get together in a cartel and to price, etc., in a monopoly way, it's ultimately going to hurt the consumers. Now, on the one hand, we don't want the type of competition where they're going to kill each other, right? Right? We would like a free flow of the product. We want it to be available when we need it, etc. On the other hand, we don't want a situation where they're going to charge whatever they feel like it. So therefore, this Adam Chashuv is a regulatory board, the assumption is. This is a man who is both a scholar in Torah knowledge and also a scholar as well in economics and in the marketplace. So this is a person who would be able to come out there and understand this is a reasonable law, this is not a reasonable law. If the person does not check off on it, it's useless. You cannot make laws on yourself. That is the assumption of the Adam Chashuv. There are a few basic questions which one has to deal with. One question is as follows. In order to unionize, in order to get a group together, do you need majority rule or unanimous rule? That is the question. And there's a lot of discussion about that.
What's the question again? Sorry.
Whether in order to get a union together you need a majority to agree or you need unanimous. This is an issue that's going on in American law now. So does someone want to pick up Obama for you? It's a shame to leave him holding.
Marilyn knows him. She'll answer.
Okay. So the question is as follows. So this actually comes up a lot. So when a little bit of American legal history, originally in the early 20th century, unions were illegal. Why? As we said earlier, it was seen as a form of a monopoly. It's a violation of the Sherman Antitrust Act. That we are capitalists. We very much support free flow of markets. We like competition. If all of the producers of anything, of bread, of oil, would get together to set prices, we would break that cartel. So too, if all of the workers get together to set prices, the government originally took the approach that they would break that cartel as well. Eventually, the Taft-Hartley Act comes along and undoes that. And Taft-Hartley says that, in fact, no unions are different. They are not subject to the laws. The problem is, at this point, you know, well, things, believe it or not, unions can also go wrong as well. It might be hard for people to accept. But as much as we all thought that unions would save all the world's problems, ultimately the unions made a lot of the world's problems. So, for example, the union leaders, for example, are skimming the money off the top. So I say, what do I need to be a member of a union for? I don't want to be a member of a union. A union costs me union dues, right? A union costs me when they say to strike, I have to strike, and I'm not going to get paid for that time. So me, as an individual worker, I turn around and say, what do I need this for? Why do I want to be part of a union? So I've made the decision. I see what the non-unionized workers get. I see what the unionized workers get. I see what it's going to cost me. I don't think it's worth paying for. I'm not getting that much out of it. Therefore, I don't want to be part of the union. The union says we insist. So there's something around the states called the right to work laws. The right to work laws, depending on state to state, determine whether or not you have a right to opt out of the union. On the one hand, if you force everyone to be in the union, the possibility of fraud on behalf of the union heads, etc., is very real. And in fact, you have cases where I end up giving money to these union heads. They're not really doing much for me, right? And in fact, they get me into more trouble than anything. So on the one hand, you want to let the people out. On the other hand, there's definitely this idea of the free rider motive that I can say, well, there's a union here. They have already negotiated, right? They've already gone on strike. Now let me get those wages and let me get everything that they fought for nothing. So that's the question. The question is, let's say the majority of the workplace is already union. Do I have an option to say I do not want to be a part of the union? This is a discussion in the Gemara. The Gemara has a discussion. What does it take in order to pass laws? Does it take majority rule? Or does it take unanimous rule? It's interesting that there is a comment in the Rishonim that says that if you look at the Tanakh closely, there seems to be certain proofs that definitely majority would be enough. Two interesting stories. Story number one is as follows. We're all familiar with the story. Joseph is sold by his brothers. Goes down to Egypt. In Egypt, eventually he is sent to prison. Works his way up. He's now the king. He's second to the king of Egypt. Viceroy. Excellent word. So he's the viceroy of Egypt. And here, now eventually his brothers come down, etc. Very Jewish question. How come he never wrote a letter home? Right? He doesn't write. He doesn't call. Right? It's a basic question. You know? Why? When he's sitting and he's a slave, when he's in prison, okay, we understand why he doesn't call. Now he's a big Kanaka, right? Which is another word for viceroy. Right? Right? At that point, why doesn't he go pick up a phone, you know, send a text, you know? Have someone go out there and say, "Hi, Dad, it's me. Good news." You know, he knows his father is suffering. Why doesn't he step in and do something about it? So there are several answers that are given. One answer that's offered is perhaps that he saw the dreams that he had of the stars and the sun, the moon, and the stars bowing down to him, that was a prophecy that he, in fact, had to make come true. And that's why he arranges that everyone comes down to bow down to him before he does that. It's a very weak answer. Right? Besides everything else, if I get a prophecy, it's not my job to make it come true. If God tells me a prophecy, it's God's job to make it come true. It's not my problem. You know, God, if you want this to happen, take care of it yourself. Right? So again, so that's a very weak answer. So the Medrash offers another answer. It says that at the time when they threw Yosef into the pit, they all got together, all the brothers, and they said, okay, we hereby take an oath, and we make a cherem, that nobody's allowed to tell Yaakov what happened. Right? Under penalty of being cursed, nobody's allowed to do it. So Yosef heard about that, and he was also stuck. As long as the brothers had this curse, or they had this rule going on that no one's allowed to tell, with that being said, he is stuck. He can't tell them. So they say, think about this. You have here a law. The law is you're not allowed to tell. Did Yosef agree to the law? Clearly not. Right? He was not happy about it. One could bet pretty good money that he was very not happy with what was going on. And still, he found himself to be, considered himself to be bound by it. So again, obviously, you didn't have unanimous approval, you had majority rule. You see from there that majority rule is sufficient. That's story number one. Story number two goes like this. That there was a battle at the time when Shaul was the king between the Jews and the Philistines, the Pelishtim. The Pelishtim have the upper hand, and Yonasan, the son of Shaul, decides that he's going to, on his own, do a surprise attack. Turns out very well. While he's gone, he doesn't hear this, his father, Shaul, gets up and he says, "We're going to fight today. I hereby say that anybody who eats this day, you know, is liable for the death penalty." Yonasan goes out, he is victorious, he chases off the entire Philistine army, comes back, eats some honey. But they decide he's got to be put to death. Eventually works itself out, but wait a second. He never agreed to this. He never heard about this. I can tell you he's bound by it, he never agreed to it. So the answer is that one approach could be that you see that majority has to be enough. You do not need unanimous rule in order to pass a law. That is the understanding. Now, of course, both of these cases, one could ask questions on. For example, in the second case, wait a second, it wasn't everyone getting together to make a law. It was the king declaring a law. Right? So that's not exactly the same thing. Right? The king obviously has powers to set the laws without anyone else agreeing. But that's what's out there. That's what's offered. And there's a long, ongoing discussion. What does it take? Does it take unanimous rule, or does it take just majority rule? One could actually phrase it a little bit differently if you wanted to. You could phrase it like this. When we make a rule, we all get together. What binds us together? One approach is to say it's a partnership. I make a partnership. We decide we're going to go into business together. Right? He's going to mess up patients. I'm going to go and sue and defend him. Right? We're going to be partners. Right? There we go. Right? Okay. You know, you'll mess up. I'll be a rabbi. I'll do the funerals. Whatever it is, somehow or another, you know, we're going to pull this off together. Okay. So, let's say at some point, I'm making a lot more money on this than he is. Right, so because you know with the new healthcare there, everybody's making all the money. So he says, that's it. I decide since I'm making all the money, I don't want to split with him anymore. So whatever we did already, it's a partnership. I can't get out of it. I made an agreement. Right, it would work out better for one than the other. Too bad you can't get out of it. So to whatever we make laws, it's a partnership. We all get together. We have an agreement among ourselves. You know that this is what we're going to do business wise, and at least on what happened previously, I can't get out of it. That's approach number one. Approach number two is no. We are naturally bound together. We're bound together naturally as members of a geographical area. We're bound together naturally as members of a profession. And therefore, we naturally are one unit. And we have to make a decision what this unit is going to do. And once the majority speaks its mind, at that point, we have a statement of what is our collective will. And we are all bound to follow that collective will. So again, if I see it as a partnership, I require unanimity, which is also a big word. And if it's an idea that there is some natural connection, then all we need is majority rule. What's the decision? What do we require in order to pass these laws? So if you look at the Shulchan Aruch, in number five, it's also said, Kovim b'nei yir zeh, that members of a city could force one another. Parentheses, the different print is the Ramah. Afilu miyut kofin esamarubim. Even the minority can force the majority, even in certain cases. So what are they? Lasos choma, l'dasayim v'riach v'ir, l'vdos l'en besa kineses. There are certain things out there that if anybody wants it, since all cities require it, that's it. For example, defense. Right? Even the majority of the people said, let's not have an army, but the minority said, we would really like a police department or something like that. Minority rules in that case. And it goes through a list. Afterwards, it goes through another list of things that aren't necessarily needed. So it says, in those cases, you have majority rule. So the assumption is that things that are true needs, it's absolutely a case of anybody can demand it, but ultimately most laws are an issue of majority rule. So what's the assumption as we placed it? That again, the fact that we live in one geographic area binds us together, right? This is a fact. We all live in the city, right? Somehow the city has to run. We need a government. We can't just everyone do whatever they want to do. We can't wait for people to donate money to build roads, right? We can't wait for people... If I said, okay, whoever wants to should contribute towards building a school. So some people will say, no, I don't have kids. My kids already moved out. Free rider. I'll wait for the other guy to pay for it. So therefore, it's necessary in order to run society that we have to get together. We have to make certain decisions what has to be done. And even though if I personally am not affected by this, I have to contribute to it. So that is what we call majority rule. And that's how things tend to run. However, if you look at the Shulchan Aruch in number 6, the Shulchan Aruch says, "Rishayim b'barei ha'umdus lasos takonos v'inmarachtam," that members of a trade can make rules affecting one another. Lifstak v'yem shol yaseh echad b'yom sheyaseh chaver k'yotzev v'zeh. An agreement that some people work on some days and some people will work on other days. V'chol sheyamav aratanai yancho oso kach. That in fact, that they can in fact say that in the event that someone violates the rules of the union, there'll be certain punishments. In order to do this, you require everybody to get me, you require unanimity. In order to have a union, it is necessary that everybody agrees totally, 100%, that this is what the rule is going to be. Meaning that if I am not interested in the rule, I can opt out. So there's a major difference here. On the one hand, when we're talking about government, we're talking about majority rule, indicating that there is something that we need. On the other hand, when it comes to unions, you require unanimous, that everybody has to agree together to do it or else it's not good. Meaning that if a bunch of people want to get together and they want to, on their own, make up an agreement among themselves, that's fine, but you can't force me to join in your agreement. What's the reason for it? Why is there a difference behind this? Well, it's somewhat obvious. Why do we have governments? We have governments because you need governments. You need to run society. You need to do things that require everyone working together. You need schools. You need roads. You need a police department. You need a fire department. You need to have this. And therefore, if we would insist on unanimous rule, it would just never happen. Society wouldn't be able to function that way. So therefore, of course, you need the majority. However, could society function without unions? Right. So the argument that why the unions get together for their own sake. Now, if you think about it, just from an American point of view, where did the union start? What were the industries that had the first unions?
Government workers.
Samuel Gompers made cigars.
True.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So what did these things have in common? This was at a time, remember, where the capitalists had by far the upper hand, right? Again, perhaps the most powerful union nowadays is United Auto Workers. Right? Why is United Auto Workers such a major union? Because there's a very minimal amount of employers. Right? There aren't that many car companies in America. Therefore, when it comes to auto workers, when you have a very small amount on one side and a very large amount of workers on the other side, there is a very strong advantage in negotiating. There's a limit to where you can go, right? Much like the NFL. Okay, so we're not going to play for the NFL, instead we're going to play for the ballet. What are you guys going to do exactly? What else are you going to do? Now I'm going to become a rocket scientist. I'm not going to be a linebacker anymore, right? There isn't a lot out there. So the idea is, in basic economics, is you want to have a level playing field to get a fair outcome. So when you're dealing in something like, for example, auto workers, but in earlier days, how many cigar makers were there?
Thousands.
Big ones?
There were almost no big ones, but there were thousands. And the union, the auto workers union, was not successful until the 30s with the Wagner and Davis Acts, as you well know.
Right.
Because in a time when...
Because when you're big, you also got union busting.
Yeah.
Right, okay, but again, union busting is not a good thing.
Well, I'm not so willing to go that far, but... The fact is, were it not for the impetus of an ideologically driven president at that time, the unions as we now know them would not exist.
Right. And just like, so for example, union law, labor law, is something that's constantly moving. In 2009, there was something called the Employee Free Choice Act, which was offered up for it never quite made it through legislation. It recently reached its two-year mark and died. And no one has reintroduced it as of yet. Which basically says as follows. There's certain rules that the National Labor Relations Board has to certify a union. Right? The union has to be certified, and once it's certified, it has certain rights. Among the things you have to do nowadays to certify a union is that a certain amount of people have to sign a petition, a certain percentage that they are interested in having a union. Then 90 days later, there is a secret ballot. And in that secret ballot, if they get a majority, then the union is certified. The argument that unions have is that during that 90-day period, the employers take the opportunity to fire the people who are supporting the union and shake down the other people to make sure that they will not get the vote. They already see who signed the petition, They know who the Charles, so they know that those guys, if we get rid of them, those are definitely votes that we win. Right? And then beyond that, also they say, they make it clear to the other people that you don't really want a union here. Therefore, the legislation would have allowed that you would, as long as 60% of the employees sign up, that's it. Once you present your petition with 60% of the employees, that automatically certifies the union. That stops those 90 days.
And it stops the secret ballot.
Correct.
So it encourages the union boss.
Correct.
To,
absolutely.
To, you know,
absolutely.
Harass the workers.
You got it, right? So the argument on the other side is great. So, you know, as long as it's a secret ballot, I can do whatever I want. But now, you know, the union bosses are going to go kick around them and say, you know, sign the paper right now. Right. So, you know, this is an ongoing struggle as to what are the powers of the unions, what are not the powers of the unions. And it becomes very important. You know, the idea of, in order to successfully pull off a strike, you have to be unionized. Strike is the ultimate power that a union has. If they can't get certified as a union, it's not going to work. On the other hand, one has to look at it from an economic point of view and say, well, how important nowadays are unions? Like right now, everything, there's a secretary's union. Okay? There are millions of secretaries in the United States, I imagine. I imagine. Right. I still have Secretary's Day on my calendar. That's on that day, my secretary is an administrative assistant. Right? At the same time, how many people employ secretaries?
That's going down all the time.
Okay, but it's still probably a pretty big number. Right? Meaning that if one day my secretary would walk out on me, right, there would be, assuming they don't know her work, there are many people who would want to hire her. Right? There is that idea out there. So again, it's not that there is a major advantage that the employer has over the employee here. Because as much as I could get other secretaries could also get other employers quite easily. Right? So in a case like that, the question is it really important to have a union? What's a union doing for anybody? I remember my secretary is a member of the union, and they went on strike. And this used to annoy her so much because they used to stand outside and it was cold. She never liked striking. Right? So the question is, you know, there are definitely ideas out, places out there where you want to give the union a certain amount of power. But again, there are places out there where it's not really necessary. And in fact, the possibilities for abuse are that much more prevalent than the possibilities of potential gain there. So these are the issues out there. So the halacha is as follows. In the event that there is a unanimous agreement, and one would have to really consider what is unanimous agreement. Obviously not all of the people in the world, but for example, I would accept that each factory would be its own ear for this. And if all the members of a factory decide that they want to unionize, then the union is set up. Once a union is set up, they do have the rights to force other people to join the union. Right? Once there is this agreement in this area, we have a concept of b'nei umnas. We have a concept of unions, and the union is something which has the ability to force other members to come in that case, and they have certain powers as well. One could also make the argument that unanimity doesn't mean 100%. There's something we call in halacha mir hamotri, that there is a certain minority which counts. And another minority, there's a certain minority which is what we would probably call de minimis. It doesn't really count. What is that number? We assume around 10%. So 90% we would probably call unanimous as well. And therefore, once you had this set up, that would work. Now, of course, all of this has to do with there has to be some oversight. Right now, there's no such thing as an Adam Chashuv. Right? We don't have this set up anyways. And it's interesting, I put down on number 8 here, Rabbi Ben Zion Chai Uziel, the first Sfaradi chief rabbi of Israel, wrote that this is one of the things that Israel should set up. They should set up, well, the equivalent of the National Labor Relations Board. However, with people that were both Torah scholars and at the same time knew economics, knew the business place. Something where we could go and look at things and see if they're reasonable or not. In terms of practical halacha, where do strikes come up that someone's going to ask a rabbi?
Israel.
Teachers, right? Yeshivas. In the 1950s, there was a series of tshuvas written regarding whether teachers could strike or not. The one right now, you have number 9 for Moshe Feinstein, who involves a school in Detroit, where the teachers were complaining that A, they weren't getting a living wage, B, they weren't getting any wages. if they got paid, it wouldn't be enough. But beyond that, they didn't get paid. So the question is, are they allowed to strike? Are they allowed to strike and tell the board, you got to start paying us. You know, we got to start paying us, and you got to start paying us a living wage. So Rav Moshe Feinstein says as follows, number 9, Dvar HaMalamdim, Im Rasham Shel Lilmod Ba'atzvam, V'gam Lo Ranich HaAchim Lilmod. So a strike involves two things. One, just not getting up in the morning and going to work does not a strike make. Right? A strike involves stopping people, other people from going to work. So for example, when one studies labor law in general, not as far as unions are concerned, but in general the obligations of the workers and the obligations of the employees, there are serious obligations on both sides. Right? For example, an employee cannot moonlight if it's going to affect his job. Right? An employee doesn't have to daven in the middle of work. He has a shorter version in terms of when he's benching. If you're in the middle of work, there's a shortened version of that as well. Right? We're very serious about the workers giving a full day's work. On the other hand, we're also very serious about them being treated properly. Right? For example, we generally assume that the employer, in most cases, if there's no other tradition, has to feed them. He has to make sure they get paid on time, even at the cost of his own ability to make ends meet. Right? There are serious obligations on both ways, and it basically evens out. There's one obligation, though, which does not even up, is that an employee, no matter what, always has the ability to quit.
Always has the ability to
quit. The pasuk says that ki avadayhem, that we are the slaves of God. We learn avadayhem vo avadim la avadim. We are only slaves to God. No one else can make us work. If we want to walk out, we can walk out. So based on that alone, you would think, so you can strike. At any time, I can walk out. Contract, no contract, I could work out. The answer is, you can walk out, but he could hire somebody else. In order for a strike to work, you have to both be able to walk out and prevent the next guy from walking in.
They're called scabs.
What?
They're called scabs.
They are called scabs, correct? And if they could walk past the picket line and get going again, that's it. You know, as far as we're concerned, it's useless. Right, there are very few people that are that specialized that they can't get by without them. So the question here is not only are we going to stop teaching here in this yeshiva, we're going to make sure that nobody teaches in the yeshiva. So Moshe Feinstein says as follows. What's going on? So the problem is A, they're not getting paid on time, and B, they're not getting paid enough. He said, if somebody has the ability to teach Torah, they're required to teach Torah. So what's going to happen? Rav Moshe says, you're going to say, I'm walking out, I'm striking. So you turn to him and say, so what are you going to be doing today? Nothing, I guess. Okay, you're doing nothing. You're halacha. You're chayav to teach people Torah. So Moshe says, in the specific area of teachers, since there's a religious obligation to teach Torah, it's not going to help you, because once you strike, since you have nothing else to do, you're going to have to go teach Torah. So effectively, this isn't going to work. So that's his first paragraph. Second paragraph, zemidina. This is technically avol. Imu ba'ofen shein kirem kidei tzarchen. Well, if they can't put food on the table, you're going to say, too bad you shouldn't have gone into this profession. And therefore, they're having difficulty teaching properly. And they know for sure that if they take a day or two off, that will get the fire going, that people will start paying, that they'll get paid on time. And they'll in fact get paid a living wage. Then it might be worth it. Why? What do we have now? We have a bunch of teachers who are going to school who are miserable, right? They're miserable. The wife's yelling at them. They're not making a living. Their mother-in-law's yelling at them. They're not making a living, right? They're feeling bitter. They're not doing a good job. He says, if taking 2 days off of work would straighten this out, then the ultimate good would work out. He said, in that case, even though technically they'd have a problem, he thinks that he would allow it in these cases. So Moshe says that that when it comes to teachers in particular, they can only strike in a situation where it's going to be a quick strike and it's going to work. I don't know how many strikes you can guarantee that with. The last issue, he says, well, do they get paid for the days that they were on strike? So he said, you got to think about that. You got to check out if it was in fact a correct strike. What they were doing was fair. That's the story.
Who posed the Shiloh?
What?
Who posed the Shiloh, the school or the teachers?
The teachers. This was a teacher from Detroit. These, at the time, there were many Shilohs. Shlomo Zalman Auerbach got one. In fact, the person who asked him the question was very interesting, was the chief rabbi of Israel. Chief rabbi got a question. This was the 1950s. Shlomo Zalman was still a young man at the time. And they said, they turned to him and they said, no, what do you think about this? What do you think about teachers striking? So he says, the doctrine, if they say we're working too hard, we want to work less, they can't strike for that. Right? Because whatever, this is what you're doing for a living. He says, however, if there really it's an issue that they're not making a living wage, and he says, interesting, even if they contracted for this number, why? You have to remember, Israel in the 1950s, we're talking about hyperinflation. So I contract for X amount of shekels, I'm not making it anymore. He said, you've got to adjust. You can't expect your workers to be working for less than a living wage. So based on that, he says that he thinks that they're allowed to strike, that in fact it's incumbent upon the board to pay them a living wage. And if they refuse to pay a living wage, they have a right to do whatever they want to get the living wage. So the assumption in all these cases is that there might be something differences as far as just people who teach Torah go. But in terms of the overall idea of striking, that, yeah, there are definitely cases where it is allowed. And not only that, but you'd be able to stop other people from crossing the line. I'll just mention quickly that most of the questions that come up nowadays, there are many wrongful termination suits that come up, which are also involved in labor law. Particularly in yeshivas. And wrongful termination suits definitely work the opposite of the economy. As the economy goes down, the wrongful termination suits go up. When the economy is good, you get fired, you get a new job. You know, you're a little bit bitter, but you move on. The economy's bad, you fire, you don't have a new job, you have no choice but to sue to try to make a living. Right? So therefore, there's a lot of wrongful termination suits going on. When it comes to yeshivas and teachers in particular, there are two major issues that always come up. One is the idea of tenure. Does halacha support the idea of tenure? If someone's been teaching for 3 years, is there what's called chazaka? And therefore, you do not have a right to fire the teacher. That is question number one. Question number two is what's called ha'anaka. It's a modern Hebrew word based on the biblical word, and it means severance. Are teachers entitled to severance in general? The basic outline of the rules are as follows. The normal assumption by most poskim is that there is no such thing as tenure when it comes to teachers. Unless you contracted for it, there is no tenure. It's interesting how this plays out practically. Is there are certain schools, I could tell you, where in the contract it says specifically, you get no tenure. Note, this is what we're telling you. There is no tenure. There are certain schools out there which make it very clear, yes, there is tenure. After 3 years, you will be evaluated. If you get hired for the fourth year, you are guaranteed a job from here on in. Which approach is better? It's not an easy call. Because both approaches are better than not writing anything. Right, not writing anything doesn't help anybody. But when you write it in, the schools that have tenure, you run into a problem of a young teacher who's been there for 2 years, is doing a pretty good job, but you know you don't have the comfort level that you're ready to hire them for the next 40. And therefore you end up firing the teacher because you know you have no other choice. Right? Either I'm going to take a leap of faith and get stuck with a dud for the next 40 years potentially, or I'm going to have to let him go now. So, schools, before they write up their contract, what is they should put the, one way, whatever they're going to do, it should be in the contract, right? Don't do it Hamish, as we say, right? But think out what the meaning of either one is. That's what. In terms of Hanukkah, the Board of Jewish Education writes in their standard rules for all schools that teachers are entitled to 1 month severance per year worked, up to a maximum of 12 months. I mean, if someone's been there 12 years or more, they get 1 year of severance. This is what's written by, according to the BJE, the Board of Jewish Education. I could tell you that hardly a school in the United States of America follows this rule.
They can't afford to.
What?
I assume they can't afford
some
to.
Some can, some can't. But
RCA also has that clause.
Yeah?
Can't hear.
He says the RCA, when it comes to hiring rabbis, is the same clause. I was unaware of that. So the idea being as follows. On the one hand, severance makes sense. You know, someone's worked for you a certain amount of years. You know, if one should get a payment upon being asked to leave before their time in such a situation. That is a true point. On the other hand, you run into issues of for cause or not for cause. I had a Din Torah, fascinating, where a fellow came up and he was terminated when the school claimed for cause, and he said it was not for cause. What did he do? So it's very interesting. He was more of a right-wing background, and he was a special ed teacher. And among the things that happened was he sat down with a parent who was very upset that their daughter, who was in third grade, still couldn't read. And he wanted to tell them it's not really a problem. He said, don't worry, it's not so bad. I mean, she's only a girl. Now, he thought that this was just the nicest comment one could make. For some reason, in the community where he was teaching, it wasn't taken as good. And this was one of several faux pas that he had done over time. So what is considered for cause, what is not considered for cause, that is a question. Therefore, there are schools out there that point out that you can be fired for any reason. For cause, not for cause, and you're not entitled to anything no matter what. If you contract to that, you are in fact are bound by that. These rules of severance, technically according to the BJE, are limited to Jewish studies teachers. The question is, what about administrators? Right? What about secular teachers? What about? You know, how about I'm a secular teacher, but you know, I invite my students over for sukkahs to my sukkah. Right? And therefore, you know, I teach them to make brachas there. Does that make me a religious studies teacher? These are all excellent questions. And does this whole thing exist at all? I'll just note that what I'm giving you is what I think is the majority opinion. Rav Moshe Feinstein, on the other hand, has a very different opinion, and as far as I know, no one follows it. According to the opinion of Rav Moshe Feinstein, you can never fire a teacher without going to a Beis Din first. And you first have to go to a Beis Din, and the Beis Din has to say it's for cause before you can fire. And in the event that you fire the teacher without, the teacher has a right to collect his salary up until the time that it goes to Beis Din. That is the opinion of Rav Moshe Feinstein. I believe that is a minority opinion. I don't believe that anybody follows it as far. Maybe MTJ follows it, but that's about it. So this is a basic overview of labor law. We've got a few minutes, 5 minutes, let's say, for questions before we have to go to Bencha. Yes?
What about layoffs? You go to the Beis Din, you said, I didn't want to get rid of the guy, but right now we're in a bad state financially. We'll hire him back if we get a chance. How does Beit Din react to that?
Right, so again, a Beit Din is not going to come out and say, no, you have to hold on to all your employees, and with that, your business will collapse, and with that, you know, then nobody will get paid. Mm-hmm. Obviously, everyone has to be reasonable. Again, we're only talking about teaching positions here. In general, when it comes to a larger picture of layoffs, that's a whole different ballgame.
What about where you have like an annual or a biannual contract? Instead of firing somebody, you wait till the contract's up and say, simply, we're not renewing.
Well, that happens in all of these cases, right? Is there a difference between not renewing and firing?
Right.
So again, if someone's, when it comes to something like severance, the assumption is that, you know, not renewing is the same as terminating. There happens to be an area where it's very important that they have rules. Most schools, you know, have the rule that there is a deadline. That in the event that you're not going to be invited back, they have to tell you by a certain date. That's very important, because you have to tell a teacher, for example, in June, you're not coming back next year, and now start looking for a job.
It's harder to find.
Right, that's not reasonable. So again, that happens to be an important part of the contract, a date, whether it's March 1st, April 1st, that's pretty much on the late side, where all contracts have to be sent out. And of course, in return, there is a deadline when what contracts have to be returned by. Because for a school to start looking for a teacher in July, August is also not. Things happen, you know, people get sick, God forbid. Okay, but short of that, schools as well have a right to know who will be teaching and who won't be teaching.
They don't have workers' compensation.
So they should have workman's comp.
Right. That's what I'm saying. So they should have workman's comp. So they can get, I mean, if they're fired.
You're saying workman's comp, you're talking about unemployment.
Unemployment, I mean, yeah.
Okay, so
yes,
right.
But I'm saying unemployment, so that's not severance, that's just a
Right. So the question, does that take the place of severance, or, you know?
No,
someone's been teaching.
As long as you're paying into it.
But no, I'm
as
saying, but don't they have to pay into it? I mean, aren't institutions are supposed
yes.
to be paying into
yes,
it?
Yes, but, you know, but the idea is someone's been teaching for 40 years. Now they're 63 years old, you know, uh-huh. and it's not going to be easy for them to get another job. You know, you have 6 months of unemployment. Might not be a fair amount after this many years of dedication to mm-hmm. the institution. Mm-hmm. I think that's a fair argument. Nothing further? We should head out to Mincha. Yeah, oh, we have a question in the back. Thank you.